All right, what is going on, guys? It is time for another episode of the Chasing Waypoints podcast. And well, you read the description, and we have got... Let's just get right into it. We have got Kyle McCoy coming on today to talk a little bit about his 2024 Dakar Rally. I was a little excited. This was a good one. And Kyle did it. Made it happen in the Malemoto class. So we'll find out a little bit more about the Malemoto class, but just the 50,000 foot on that one. That is right. So Malemoto is old school. That means unsupported riders. That means no help from the outside. You got to do it all yourself. So this is the true Ironman class of the Dakar Rally. And we're going to talk a little bit about his experience for this year's event, which, you know, a little bit of unfinished business from last year. And now we've got a whole nother year of practice and getting ready. And then that's what I want to find out. I want to find out what were the differences? What did we do differently this time around? What were we more prepared for? I think that is definitely going to be an interesting one. Let's get the link on over to him. So what's going on? Have you guys been following on YouTube? I think I figured it out. I think I figured out the recipe and how we're going to do this one. We're going to wait for him to clock in here with us. But definitely considering what this is going to be in the future. If we are going to be doing the podcast and the YouTube channel, I think the YouTube channel should get some stuff, some videos, but then we'll be doing the podcast as is how it's always been, because I have a lot of fun doing it. Meeting and talking to all you guys. So we'll see. Rainy day here in San Diego. And then, of course, I got the 790 halfway apart, and then it's time to sell that thing. I got to make room in the garage for a new bike, and we're going to have to find a new owner for the 790 and get that thing going, as of course we're going back to stock. What do you guys think about selling a bike? Selling a bike is always difficult, you know? So we'll see. But flashing on over, looks like we have the man of the hour, Kyle.
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing better. I'm trying to figure out if we're going to float away later today. Getting a lot of rain down here in SoCal.
Oh, you are. That's right. Well, we flipped because that's what we do all winter here in Seattle. but it's dry at the moment.
What? What's the mountain up there? Is it Rainier? No.
Yeah, Mount Rainier. It's kind of the most famous, yeah.
Can you see it? I've been there three times and have never seen it.
I see it all the time. It's too dark at the moment, but oh, okay. I suspect I'll be able to see it soon. Yeah.
Every time I've been there three times, and all three times it was always just cloudy, rainy, and just it wasn't happening.
So yeah, you got to come in July. I say Seattle in July, or maybe early August is the best place to be in the country. 72 and sunny every day.
Nice. Yeah, see, in July, well, yeah, we'll get into the 80s down here, or, you know, 90s, it depends. So, speaking of weather, you kind of had a recent adventure.
I did.
So that was, call it that. Yeah. Last, I was like, wait a minute, I remember the day. I'm going through the numbers when Dakar issued the numbers, and then I'm scrolling through looking for everybody, you know, the names, and then I go, Kyle McCoy, wait, that's a red number. He's doing Malemoto again.
I couldn't help myself. You know, after last year, I gave myself a few months to decide, am I going to go back? Because for those that don't know, I fractured or broke my right tibia last year on stage four, which was a real gut punch. And anyhow, I gave myself about 4 months to decide, am I going to go back and do this again, and, you know, put my wife and family through it again. And I decided, yeah, I'm going to drive myself crazy if I don't go do this again. And luckily I have a wife who's very supportive. So I decided I'm going to do it.
Nice. And from there, go time. Were you in those 4 months, were you kind of like, I'm going to pretend to train? or I'm going to, or was it just, did you just decide to back off 100% from anything?
No, I backed off. I mean, I recovering from a surgery on the right leg. And then, so I didn't do much for a few months, but, to your point, no, I mean, you know, the reality, and Nathan Rafferty and I talk about this somewhat frequently. Not that I'm that fast of a rider, but I'm not going to get much faster unless I put in so much work. I mean, the incremental speed increase I could get now takes so much work, and I just don't have the time to do it. So for me, it's more about just finishing. That's the goal. And so that's what I went back and did.
Nice. Very, very nice. Yeah, I can do the 50,000 foot thing about Malimoto, right? You know, unsupported rider. You've got a trunk that you got to live out of for 2 weeks. It's sign me up for the hardest possible way to do the Dakar rally. That's how I see it.
That's it. I mean,
it's pretty accurate. I mean,
it is accurate. And I'm not a guy, look, I'm a guy who's more of a sort of a one downer, my wife likes to say, and I never try to oversell things. I never sort of overpromise, and I'd like to do the opposite. And I'm here to tell you, it is really, really hard. It is the cheapest way to do Dakar, which is what I think attracts a lot of guys. Mm-hmm. But it's also the hardest. I mean, it's the motorbikes are the hardest class. You talk to car drivers, they'll tell you the same thing, because a lot of them came from motorbikes. And so motos are the hardest class. And then you layer onto that being your own mechanic. It's brutally hard. Brutally hard, but super rewarding. And it's a group of 30. This year there were 138 starters on motos, 30 of which were Malimoto. It's very international. There were like four of us that spoke English in that group. And it's kind of a family by the end, because we can help each other. Malimoto is, you can't have any outside assistance. You can help one another though, as long as you're in Malimoto category.
Mm-hmm. So it definitely promotes the camaraderie. And I don't think that anybody else unless they've previously raced the class, I don't think anybody else really understands the undertaking that it is.
No, that's right. And there's an overall ranking, like, of 138 motos. I'm kind of a data guy, so I can kind of tell you guys some of the data. Of 138 motos, 86 finished overall. Now, it's kind of confusing on the Dakar website, because they lump quads and motos together, and they show people who didn't finish a stage but chose to carry on in sort of the new Dakar adventure category, where they let, which I think is the right thing to do, let people finish at least.
Yeah.
But there's probably 10 of those that were listed on the website that didn't finish all of Dakar. So first of all, you have a high attrition rate overall on motos. Obviously it's tough. Yeah. And then in Malimoto, it's 30 started, 20 finished, and I finished 10th, which is about where I sort of belong, right mid pack of Malimoto. Now, the guy who won Malimoto, a guy by the name of Ebster, Tobias Ebster, is Austrian. Mm-hmm. And he did extraordinarily well. He finished, I think, 20th overall, which is unbelievable. And they asked him, Red Bull asked him at the end, they were interviewing him about, will you do Malimoto again? And he said, no way.
Princess.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, he's trying to compete with the top riders, and he's like, I can't do it in this category.
Yeah.
So my point to all that is, you know, you have to think about it from an endurance standpoint. When on the rest day, when everybody else is going to the hotel and relaxing, we're there working on the bike all day. There is no rest.
Yeah, it's more like maintenance day, I feel.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I'm, you know, my friends know I'm at my, you know, look, I think in rally racing, there are three sort of three skills, right? You have speed and overall skill on a motorbike. A lot of guys have that. Mm-hmm. Then you have navigation skills. And then you have mechanical skills. And my weakness on that three-legged stool is mechanical historically. So I'm really proud of myself for getting through it, mostly from the mechanical aspect.
Yeah. Which I mean is not, I mean, the mechanical thing is any, at any given point, you know, it could literally turn to that. And I have a question definitely about the preparation side of it, only because I recently, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do the SoCal rally. I haven't been on a bike in a while, so I need to, you know, start working on something. So I'm curious about your training. But before we get into that, what you just said about the mechanical side of things, you had a pretty big day one of the days down in the dunes. I remember hearing the story and having to basically, I think it was diagnosing the fuel system in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And even in words, I have a hard time describing how difficult that sort of really hour was for me, but I'll try to describe it here. And basically what happened was it was stage 7, which is this stage after the rest day. They decided we're going to make this hard. The total distance, because in the theory we had this rest day, even though Malimoto, again, we didn't have a rest day. So the total distance that day was just shy of 1,000 kilometers, just to set perspective. And so it's a long day. Mm-hmm. And I'm
600 plus, just over 600 miles for those playing the home game.
Right. Right. And the special was just shy of 500 kilometers of that. So long special section too, which also doesn't do it justice because it was just a really hard special. In my opinion, it was the hardest. So in any event, I'm halfway through the special. And about halfway through each stage, on longer stages, the top cars catch the mid pack of the bikes. And one of them caught me right as I'm going over a dune, steep dune. And it surprises me. And I have a silly, like small fall at the bottom of the dune on the backside. And it wasn't anything out of the ordinary. I jumped up, picked the bike up. I wanted to get out of the way. And the bike doesn't start. So I first scramble up the dune, put my helmet there. You know, of course I'm sweating at this point.
Yeah.
I put my helmet, and the cars and bikes are now really starting to come around. They have a hard time seeing me. I was in a bad spot. So in any event, I spent the next 20 minutes trying to figure out what was wrong with the bike. It was too loud for me to tell at first, but finally when it got quiet, I heard the fuel pumps not actuating whenever I press the starter button. So, you know, thank God I remembered Bart Vandevelden telling me if the fuel pump, and that's for those that don't know BAS, Dakar, BAS, Dakar. If the fuel pump isn't firing up, you can't hear it. It's a 90%+ probability that it is your fuel switch that toggles between the front and the rear tanks. And there is a shortcut, a bypass that you can plug in that basically makes it run off one or the other. Luckily, I was able to sort of come to my senses and remember that. And I sort of took it apart on the tower, and you have to unplug the fuel pump and plug in this little loop circuit. And that's all it does, is it runs off one or the other. When that bike started up, I nearly started crying. I was so happy. So happy. Cause I mean, that was it. I mean, I was in critical moments there of figuring this out. There was no way I could be towed, cause I knew all this. It was sand dunes. You just can't tow in sand dunes. Mm-hmm. So nobody's going to tow me. Basically my race would have been over if I hadn't figured that out. I was also on the backside of a dune where nobody's going to stop and help me because they don't know it's me until it's too late.
Yeah.
For those friends that would have stopped. You know, I'm figuring out all this. I'm a positive guy, but I realize this is a pretty bad moment. And so when it started up, I was so happy.
Yeah. That first,
but then I realized,
I can only imagine that first pop.
Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah.
I shouted into the air. The other thing is that the French organization, after about 5 minutes of just sitting there, they start calling you. And so on your bike, mm-hmm. you know, I have this Eritrack, and it's just this fancy phone system connected to satellites. And literally a speakerphone comes on and starts talking to me. And, you know, the guy from Paris, literally sitting in an office in Paris, says, you know, number 32, are you okay? And I say, yes, I'm okay. It's a mechanical. And so then he says, how long will it take you to fix it? And I thought to myself, what in the hell kind of question is that? And I said, I don't know, you know, I'm sorry. I need the time. And he comes on again, says it again, and 2 minutes later, and then 2 minutes later. And finally I shouted at this poor French guy, hey man, I need you to really shut up at the moment. I said it far more directly. Mm-hmm. He'll remember who I am forever, I think, but it was a stressful moment.
Oh man. Yeah. See, smart ass Victor would have told him, you know what? I've got it hooked up on the dyno right now. The diagnostic computer is running. The tech just stepped out for lunch. He should be back in about 30 minutes. How about that? God, I mean, and to credit them, I've seen the ops side of that and how that works and how like literally convenient, like they dial the number on the phone and then it calls you directly from a voice over IP type setup, which is really cool. I mean, but on your side of it, you know, I can only imagine, you know, the frustration of, you know, being in a bad spot, recognizing that you're not an ideal geographic location based on, you know, being on the backside of a dune and then the heat and then having to figure this out, you know, and then I can picture it being either the car making noise or this phone going off and you're trying to listen for fuel pumps.
Yeah, that's it. And by the way, the technology is amazing. It's super, it makes you feel safe. I mean, they do a good job staying in contact, but at that moment it was definitely annoying. Well, and the last part I'll tell you on that day was that I realized as I'm riding away, I started doing some math in my head and I realized, look, I'm going to finish this stage in the dark. And that's the first time I've done a lot of rallies mm-hmm. and I've never had finished a stage in the dark. And this Dakar, because of how difficult they made it, you know, I'm mid pack and I'm finishing multiple times in the dark. And I, you know, that particular stage, it was stony. It was the boulder, you know, these small boulders and cars and trucks all around, a dust storm. You know, I'm barely able to see from that bobbly headlight. Mm-hmm. And so it was a nightmare getting in, but I was still so happy because I was just able to finish on my own.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's that in over and over again, right? That many, having to finish that many kilometers, that many stages, and just to be able to, and in the dark, completely different. I mean, it's not an easy feat. And there's another thing, and I got to mention it really quickly. There's also another thing that's not an easy feat when everybody seemed to be collecting them. You actually had a clean run. No penalties on the fourth entirety of the event.
I know I did. And well, yeah, I thank you for noticing that. And some people would say, well, Kyle, you're going too slow if you have zero penalties. And there's probably some truth to that. But my greatest skill in rally is navigating. And so there was never a question I was going to not get a waypoint. They did some challenging navigation stuff this year, but I just was able to pick it all up and didn't have any speeding penalties. And so I was proud of that. You know, at the end of the day, that time adds up. And you know, over a course of 13 racing days, actually 14 racing days this year at Dakar, you know, all those add up, especially if you miss a waypoint.
Yes. And then to be fair, there's only literally in the class, there's only two people that did what you did. It was yourself. And then it was the guy that finished in 14th, from Italy. I'm looking at the results right now. And I mean, it's not an easy, and I know I could probably go back and look, like, even if I look at the pro guys, I bet you everybody had penalties. So that's a very, considering that you can get caught out, you know, on something on a speed zone. The speed zone is usually the one that's the most common. You know, they play right. Chicken with the start of the speed zone and ultimately end up picking up a minute or two, or if they blatantly missed it, they pick up 10 minutes, you know, in 10 feet.
Right. So, exactly.
So very well done on that part.
Well,
all
thanks.
Of it, and all of it. I mean, seriously, dude, that is such a crazy accomplishment. Where, I know you know the numbers. What was the, how many people have finished from North America, or at least from the U.S., the Malimoto class?
Yeah. Well, I was the only one in Malimoto this year. And so that makes three of us that have finished Malimoto from the U.S. Angelo Peter Vilchick, Mo Hart, and then myself. And then, but you, overall, there were six Americans this year and four, well, a couple of interesting things. Four finished of the six. The two that didn't, it was mechanical. It was not injury. That was Skyler and Mason had mechanical challenges. But the good news this year was there wasn't a single American injury. And that's pretty rare. When I say rare, like, I don't know that that's ever happened. So it's pretty rare. I mean, you know, yeah. So that was kind of cool. Like, nobody got hurt. Although there were two mechanical issues, and I felt bad for Skyler and Mason. At least they weren't hurt, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's a very big difference. I mean, like your experience, you know, it forces you to have to take time off the bike, time off of training, the possibility of going to another event. You know, it's a much longer process than if it was a mechanical where, you know, they nailed down what it was and then, you know, off to the races.
Right. So, right. Exactly.
So kind of going back a little bit, right. You had those 4 months off and, you know, you decide, all right, it's time we're going to go. What was the preparation like? I mean, are you somebody that's like always at the gym, you know, the food, the training, any kind of like, I'm really curious about that. As I mentioned, you know, I'm just kind of starting this journey late, obviously, to go to the SoCal rally. And I've just been kind of hyper-focused on the training side of things and what people do for that.
Yeah. You know, for me, like I mentioned, I have a full-time job. I'm just a privateer there at Dakar. So I can't afford to spend that much time riding the bike, although I should ride more. So I knew I'm not going to get any faster. I'm not that fast, but to incrementally improve, it takes a lot of work once you're at a decent pace, you know? Mm-hmm. So I just spend a lot of time on fitness, and I'm just naturally kind of a fitness freak. And so, you know, I was a runner before. I like to exercise near every day. I'm exercising probably 4 or 5 days a week. In the gym, doing a lot of strength training and balance training. And so to me, that was a no brainer. I did some riding, not a lot, some trials riding, a little bit with Paul Neff, for those that know him. But no, literally I didn't do a rally last year, which is kind of crazy. But that's okay, because I told my wife, look, I'm spending a lot of time away from you for this race, and I have two little kids, a 6 and a 9-year-old. Uh-huh. So I sort of picked my battles, and that was it. On the food, you know, I wouldn't say I'm that overly conscious on super healthy food, but I definitely pay attention to what I'm eating and try to be smart about what I'm eating and eat real food. Those are kind of my rules.
I know. Yeah, just try and keep it simple and not, you know, overdo it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, because I've seen that. You start getting into the YouTube videos and then the algorithm takes you over. Next thing you know, you're, you know, signing up for some weird, you know, diet, and, you know, they're calculating the micro macro nutrients or something like that. And the position of mercury versus your diet. And I mean, just it's just a slippery slope. I'm like,
no, it's easy.
Yeah,
exactly. Easy to go down a rabbit hole and never sort of pick your way out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. What do they call that? Decision paralysis. That's the term. It's like, all right, what are we going to do? So, God, I can't, you know, what was the stage? What was your, you know, if you could pack the bike up and go just run one more stage, which one would it be for you?
Oh man, that's a great question. To me, it was the 48-hour chrono, which I don't think you'd have a lot of people say that in response, but it was my favorite. It was just it was unbelievable. It was, for those that didn't track the Dakar, they did what's called a 48-hour chrono, which was a single stage, which was really 2 days. And it was 625 kilometers of sand dunes, which is hard to process for those that have done sand dunes. But basically we rode 100 kilometers on the highway transfer to the start of the special. And then they basically just had us ride as far as we could until 4:30 PM. And then we're at the next checkpoint. And so there's some interesting strategy. And by the way, then you finish the next day in the order that you came into that checkpoint. There's some interesting strategy to it, which I realize as we're going along, and that you want to push it to the next checkpoint. But if you end up out in those dunes in dark and you don't judge it right, then you're in big trouble. And we had some, and we had some guys do that. Like, people ended up in the dunes, just slept in the dunes in between checkpoints in the dark with nothing there. There's no vehicles that can get to them, nothing. And they also, the time kept running for them, whereas the time stopped for us that made it into a checkpoint. And I like that stuff. I'm more of an endurance guy. So it was a harder day endurance wise. It wasn't that fast because we're on dunes, and some of the dunes were super technical. A lot of straight up, straight down type dunes, level three, they call it. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's when I can excel. And I kind of had my best stage at the 48 hour chrono. And then we're out there in the middle of nowhere, and they give us these Saudi military rations and a cheap tent. And, you know, there's car drivers, there's guys driving $1 million rigs right next to you, which is cool. Sort of everybody's equal out there, you know, in the desert.
They're struggling with tents. Yeah. Struggling to pop up a tent.
Oh yeah. You can tell they were hating life, but it was great.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, and it's interesting that you would say, like, I think that, and I don't know what your opinion on it, but I have a feeling that we've just seen the replacement of the marathon stage. Like, I don't know if they're going to do the marathon stage and maybe favor doing these chrono stages, because I think it went well.
I definitely think it went well. I know they got a lot of good feedback. They're going to get a lot of good feedback. I would argue they're going to do both. I mean, they're trying to make it harder. Mm-hmm. They're trying to make it harder overall while not increasing speed. Mm-hmm. And those are hard things to do. And I think they'll do both a marathon, just like this year, a marathon stage and a 48 hour chrono, which you're right. They're basically the same thing. And what a lot of people didn't realize though, was that there's some oddity in the way the logistics work after the 48 hour chrono, because for example, I finished at 2:30 PM the next day out of the transfer and waited until 8:30 to board a flight. They had us all board a flight in our gear. So think about it. I've been wearing my gear for 2 days. It was pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
In my case, I've been wearing it like 4 days, but in any event, we were all pretty gnarly, and they had us just carry our stuff, get on a flight an hour and a half to Riyadh. And by the time we got there, it was 10:30. I go back to the bivouac, and this was just before rest day.
Yeah.
So my point is, the bikes then board a truck to be driven 12 hours. And so I'm without my bike, and I got to start working on it. Mm-hmm. And so that was a little bit stressful. I think they need to sort out the logistics on that 48 hour chrono. But to your point, Victor, that it was a success, and I think they'll keep doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. That's an interesting one. I wasn't 100% sure on how this whole flight thing was working and all that stuff. And I mean, to me, in my mind, that the first thing that they got to figure out is, yeah, if they're going to do a chrono stage, it finishes at the bivouac, because you're, it is something like that. And especially for, I mean, the other guys, right. But for you, that's very critical. You think about it. I mean, that's, you know, time, you're always on the clock in the Malamoto class, it seems. Like, there's never a time you're not on the clock, whether it's your stage time or whether it's the time between the stages. And to have to basically throw away, you know, finishing at 2:30, leaving at 8:30, and then waiting another 12 hours for your bike, you know, you're throwing away, where I'm picturing, if you would have been at the bivouac, finished at the bivouac, there would have been maybe an hour or two, get some rest, come back, do some more, you know, like, your time management is completely different now.
It's completely different. You're right. And for those of us in Malamoto, we unquestionably, we lost some time from all that, but you know, it was okay in the end. I slept in the bivouac. You know, this is rest day. Everybody's gone except for Malamoto people. Mm-hmm. I slept in the bivouac, and then the bike showed up at like 5:30 AM. And I started working at 6:30 AM on the rest day. And the thing about Malamoto is, we become sort of, I joke around, we become like a petting zoo on rest day because all the pro riders are gone. You know, think about it. They're at the hotel relaxing and the Mally Moto guys are there and we're a scene because we're all working on our bike, trying to get stuff done. So what happens is inevitably everybody from the bivouac just comes, that's hanging out, and all these VIPs, and they want to stare and sort of chit chat. So I got some good advice from some veterans in Mally Moto, and they said, look, Kyle, start early, finish early. So I started at like 6:30 AM. Nobody's there. It's nice and cool. And I worked for, I don't know, 6 hours straight and finished sort of right around lunchtime.
Yeah.
And then literally you have Saudi royalty coming through there and doing interviews, Red Bull, like the whole nine yards, they're all coming through and chatting. So most people didn't get much work done after afternoon.
Once everybody woke up and the cameras were ready and
that's it. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's crazy. It's these little, like it is literally these little things. Cause I mean, I can literally see, yeah, you're in the bivouac. Yeah. You're in comfortable clothes, but it can get to the point like you feel like you're in a dune, backside of the dune, trying to figure out the fuel, like the same kind of scenario, right? It's just constant interruptions when you know that, you know, the task I'm performing is going to be a 2 hour task. And if I keep stopping, it's going to be 4 hours before I'm done with this. Hey guys, what's going on? This is Victor with the Chasing Waypoints podcast. Hey, super quick break in the episode. Let's talk about it. We have got the newsletter. If you have not signed up for that already, get on over to the link in the description, head on over to the website and get signed up. So looking to bring you guys information on both Chasing Waypoints upcoming episodes, rally schools, rally events coming up, videos, all the stuff that we've got going on in the rally community here in North America and abroad. We're looking to share that with you guys. So if you haven't already, jump on over. Link is in the description. Head on over to the website, get signed up for the newsletter, and let's get back to the episode.
That's it. And, you know, look, some of the, it's really, my view on these bikes that I rode a KTM, and look, there's a lot of good bikes out there. Obviously, Honda's got it dialed now, but they don't make those, they don't make enough of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kobe's got some pros and cons. Obviously, they're still dialing some things, but look, these bikes are incredible. And especially the KTMs, because they've been doing it so long that if something goes wrong on the bike, it's probably human error. In most cases, it's going to be my fault. And by the way, there were at least two top riders this year who didn't finish because of a human error, because literally a bolt wasn't tightened. Yeah. And that's rough. But I don't blame them. It's bound to happen. Like at some point, we will all make a mistake. Mm-hmm. So to your point, Victor, I was like obsessive about, I'm not talking, I'm not chatting until I finish my work, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'm a chat all the rest of the day, but it's really easy to, and that thing is my life blood out there. Like if I mess that bike up, it's on me, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I had a lot of work, like we're swapping out chains, chain guides, oil filters, air filters. We're doing all kinds of stuff to the bike. And there's little meticulous stuff, to do, like the gas filter. There's a tiny little gas filter, on those bikes, and making sure that that's correct. I had to check my clutch, open up the engine, make sure the plates were good. So there's a lot of work, but also the bikes are so good that, you know, I'll tell you this, the Mally Moto organizers told me that about 4 years ago, a guy came and did Mally Moto, didn't change the oil the entire race, was afraid to sort of to change the oil.
Yeah.
And this was on a KTM, and the bike finished, which is, no big deal. It finished 5,000 mile race, no oil change. Now, I wouldn't recommend that. I changed mine, but he probably did some damage to the, but it did it. It finished the bike.
I am sure that thing is clapped. And I mean, you know, it wouldn't, that's the interesting part. It's not recreational riding. So even, you know, it's still racing, you know, you've got dunes upon dunes, you know, even if it's just a few days, or more than a few days in this case. So I hear you. It's like, I can only imagine that it's one of those things like, you know, I know it's probably good, but if I don't check it, this is literally what I'm going to be thinking about all day tomorrow, and I need all my brain power to navigate.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. That is exactly right. Yeah. Do the right amount. And I know I got in a pretty good rhythm. For me, it's change the oil every two or three stages, depending on how difficult the stages were. Mm-hmm. Change the tires every two or three stages. Mm-hmm. Again, depending on how rough they were. And you alternate those so that you're not doing them on the same day. So,
okay.
You know, and every minute counts to your earlier point. Like normally Rafferty and I love, you know, I love listening to Nathan Rafferty as a good buddy. And mm-hmm. when we finish a special, we'll listen to music on a transfer. In this case, I didn't do it one time because I was so stressed about time that I'd finish a special and not even chit chat. I'd start writing because I got to get back to the bivouac and I got to get to work.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that? Like, I mean, was that something a little bit different from the previous year? You know, in the first few stages,
it was, and I think I probably took it. Not that I was taking it that easy, but I was probably a little bit too relaxed. And then you realize, look, these veterans in Malimoto, they're obsessed with time management and at the peak of that time management priority is sleep, because if you don't get enough sleep each night, it just compounds. It's going to get worse and worse. You're going to crash. You're going to make a mistake and then you're going to have more work. Yeah. So to the extent you can manage it so that you're getting sort of at least 6 hours a night, then it's optimal. Now that doesn't always happen, but so you have to be obsessive about time management.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that may be one of those things that's like, okay, well, it sucks right now, but I know that if I just get right to work, I'll have more time on the back end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And eating as much as you can, like, you know, I mean, you know, I'm all skin and bone, Victor, right? And I lost almost 10 pounds during this race, which is crazy. Yeah. And I ate as much as I could and still you're going to lose weight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thinking about that in 2 days, just, okay. So the basic math, right? What is it? 3,000 calories per pound. So 30,000 calorie deficit across 2 weeks ish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude.
You know, there's no, you wake up and you eat as much as you can early.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to process. And then all day you're moving and I'd eat a couple of power bars as fast as I could, but then I'd eat as much dinner as I could and go back to work on the bike. So it's just hard to keep up on calories to your point.
Yeah. I mean, thinking about that, because I mean, that's the other thing. Well, it's, you know, you just eat more, but there comes a point where you do have to pick your battles. You know, okay, if I super overeat for breakfast because I'm going to be out in the desert all day, I mean, you're feeling sluggish, you feel like crap, you feel, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of an interesting.
Yeah.
There's a whole nother strategy there. It's not just that. Man.
But generally speaking, I'd say you want to eat as much as you can in the morning. You know, you're going to feel a little bit terrible whenever you start a stage, because you've just pounded all this food. But by the end of the day, you would have needed that. And so the downside to not eating enough in the morning, I think, is far worse than a little bit of a, you know, stomach ache at the beginning of the day from eating so much.
Yeah. Getting sorted. Dude, that's absolutely crazy. So, as far as recuperation goes after the rally, I mean, are you back on your normal schedule? Or, you know, everything's working, you're good to go?
Yeah, I am now. It's been 2 weeks almost, and actually almost exactly 2 weeks since the race finished. And you know, it's 11 hours ahead for those of us in the West Coast of the U.S., so it's pretty rough to get adjusted to and to come back from, obviously. But, you know, I was so exhausted, came back, got back to normal on time schedule. The thing that's lingered a little bit for me is my hands and wrists were so destroyed from the race, far more than I I've ever experienced before. Mm-hmm. They were swollen, beat to hell. You know, I lost a fingernail. Like it's rough. And because you're riding, they made it super hard riding, and then you're working on the bike, and so it just beats your hands up by the end of the race. And so those are still like the tips of my fingers. I can't feel them. They're a little bit numb still, mm-hmm. just from the beating taken out there on Dakar. But other than that, the body is good. I didn't have any injuries. So I can't, you know, I can't complain too much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, yeah, they're no major injuries. Although I know a nail is a pain in the, butt.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I mean that's good. I mean, so in the all, you know, the 30 or 50,000 foot, you know, pick your altitude view is, I mean, overall great event. I mean, to me, I know more of the admin side of it, and on a five-day rally to not get a penalty is like, yeah, all right, yeah, yeah, you know, that's pretty good. There's more people to do that, but I think even that in a rally this length. Like, there's a club for people that had clean runs. Yeah, it's.
Yeah, I think I'm, you know, that to me is important. I love the navigation aspect of rally. I sort of pride myself on that skill. Not that I'm perfect at it, but, and even I, over that distance, you know, look, there were two times where I went the wrong way for a fairly healthy amount of time and felt pretty ridiculous about it, but I got the waypoints, and I, you know, that to me is important. If I was really, and to finish the Dakar rally in Malimoto, you really have to be conservative. And I was conservative, probably slightly too conservative. If I was really pushing it and I was worried about exactly what place I came in, mm-hmm. then I probably would have had some speeding penalties. Those guys are at the front are under a lot of pressure for every second, and so of course they're going to have speeding penalties. They can't really afford to miss waypoints, mm-hmm. but they're going to have speeding penalties, to your point. And for those that aren't aware, I'm sure everybody listening here is aware, but an American won this year. What's cool about that is Ricky won this year. He also won in 2020 when I was there, so I got to watch it now two times. And you know, he's such a great guy. He's texting with me during the rally, like checking on me toward the end of the rally. And I'm like, you know, that's awesome, man, but you got bigger fish to fry. Like, you're in the lead of this whole thing.
Yeah.
So pretty cool. All those guys, up front are incredible. They take enormous risk, and, my hat's off to them.
Yeah. I mean, that is, it's, I think it was a conversation that went on with Skyler and a couple of the guys after Sonora rally. You know, we know that they had an incident. You know, Skyler had an off, and then I believe it was, I don't remember if it was Sunderland or Sanders. I think it was Sunderland. And that, what you just said very specifically came up. It's like, if it's not in the road book, we can't check up. You know, and because the guy in front isn't checking up, and if he's not doing it and I'm doing it, I'm losing a second every time. And, you know, it's like crazy to have to think that. And so it added like a whole new perspective of like, dude, these guys really have to like lay it out. And, you know, I know that they like the speed zones you were mentioning, the ERTF, I understand, works a little bit differently than like, say, a rally comp. The line is in the sand. You cross that going hot, you're getting a penalty. But from my understanding, the ERTF has like here's the line on the sand. That's your warning. Now you've got so much to rope it in, you know, and be under that speed limit. Well, the problem is now everybody goes, well, okay, well, the real line in the sand is 100 meters after this. So I have to play chicken with that 100 meter line just to get it, or whatever, you know, so it's very interesting, like the pressures and the things that they've got to do. And, you know, now these fly by wire bikes using like a speed limiter, so they don't, you don't have to manage it. Right. Cause on the RFR, you have to manually manage that. Correct.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So,
yeah. I mean, and look, the other thing I'd say, which all your point you're making is very accurate. The other thing I'd say is that, look, the lead riders aren't always right. And they could be slightly off of what the map maker intended, and still we're headed in the right, generally the right direction. But what's happened, what happens is they create a danger by virtue of just being slightly off what the map maker intended, and everybody else follows. And of course there's not going to be a warning because the map maker didn't put a warning in. They didn't intend us to go that way. Yeah. This was a huge thing. Two or three times during the race, there's a pretty big scene now where you see a truck go off a pretty high drop at high speed.
Yeah.
And then the navigator gets out and runs to warn the other because they just destroyed their tires. Well, I can tell you exactly that spot, and the entire front of the motos went the wrong way. Like, we should not have been there.
Yeah.
And it was gnarly. If you weren't paying attention, like, you had to check up on that spot because the other side, it's hard to tell, but it was pretty rough with rocks everywhere. So in any event, that's going to happen in a race. And so I'm, you know, I can't afford to not, if I can't see something, I won't ride what I can't see. But to your point, in the front, they can't take that time. They have to keep going.
It makes it seem like a luxury. And you're right on that. I remember seeing that clip that you mentioned. And at first when I saw the car go off and land, and I'm like, what was the big deal? I mean, it didn't look that big. But then when the co-driver ran back and slowed the next car down, and then I watched how much the car like leaned in, tipped over and then went down, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's not 3 feet anymore. That's like, you know, I'm looking
at it. No, it's like a 6 or 7 foot drop. I could tell you because I experienced it. And it sort of snuck up because the front side of it was pretty smooth and the back side was jagged rocks. And which is why the driver of the truck destroyed, I think, two wheels whenever he went down that thing.
Those things are super heavy, man. Crazy. But we're on the other side of it. And you had some fun.
And I was going to say the other point on the technology front, since we were talking about warnings and so those in Rally GP obviously used paper road books. Those of us in Rally 2, which there were only two of us Americans this year, I think, we used the new electronic road book, which I'm a big fan of. It works well. It simplifies life. There are a couple of things that need to improve. Specifically, it's too bright at night on transfers. Like, it blinds you. You can adjust the brightness, by the way, and it doesn't go low enough, so it blinds you and it's hard to see. And then it's too dark in the middle of the day in the dunes. It doesn't go bright enough. They're working on that, but otherwise it was flawless. I know there's been a lot of discussion about it. Yeah. I'm a huge fan. It's so easy to use. It's the future.
Now and that was something I'm curious. So they've combined it, because before you had your ERTF unit that you had to have like on the handlebars and then, you know, in addition, your road book and then your Caponotto. And so now they've basically replaced the road book and the ERTF unit with this one piece, or are you still running a separate unit?
No, you're right. One piece. So the road book is also the ERTF. And what's incredible is, you know, you don't have any of this special stage information, for example, until you get to the special. And then once you enter, they still have you enter the queue, like the road book queue. And once you enter that, you know, radius, it automatically populates the special stage road book. It's pretty incredible.
Interesting. So it's got like so they've programmed like a geofence, you know?
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but that's gotta be pretty cool. So it's like, okay, it's already on there. It's encrypted. It is what it is. It won't unlock. And then when it crosses WPE SS5, you know, then stage 5 populates all of a sudden,
you know, exactly.
Like a special wave. That's pretty awesome. But
yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, I think it sounds like I'm going to use the word negative, but the negative comments won, because it sounds like they're going to put a pause on using it for the next events because of the screen. I'm not sure if you've heard anything about that, but
I mean, it's been kind of ongoing. That's been ongoing. I haven't heard whether they've made a decision one way or the other exactly, but maybe you're right. The thing I would say is that David Castera, the organizer of the Dakar, mm-hmm. he is hugely focused on making it digital for good reason. It's just easier to manage and all those things. So, you know, even if they pause it, it's not going to stop. It's the future. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah.
Because ultimately you had the bulk of the racers this year use it and finish, no problem. So now we know it works. It's just they need to fine tune it. Yeah. I know the screen, the brightness in particular.
Yeah. So that's just going to be the next step. But I mean, like you said, I mean, they're, it's not like they've got 12 things to work on. It's now they're just narrowed it down.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I know you got to get, I know it's bright and early for us and you probably got to get out the door, but, what do we have in closing? Who, you know, sponsors, anybody you want to thank, anybody you want to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, you know, I have a couple of sponsors that, you know, my sponsors, I don't have any monetary sponsors because I'm very, I'm lucky to be able to afford to do this race and my wife lets me do it. Like I say, obviously Nally Moto is the cheapest way to do it. And I'm happy to share with anyone that wants to know sort of the cost breakdown, but Climb Motorcycles been really good to me and support and sponsoring me with gear and the stuff works. I mean, I used two sets of Climb Dakar kit this year and the Climb, the new F3 Pro helmet, which is I think the lightest helmet on the market, or it's at least in the top five of the lightest. So it's super light and durable. Mm-hmm. I used that helmet throughout. It was amazing. Giant Loop is also a sponsor and really, really good to me. And then RMS, you know, they're incredible. I just get my gear from them. But yeah, so thanks for bringing that up. And the other thing I would say, just the rally community has been so good to me over the years. I've been riding 10 years. And I've learned so much from the veterans of the Dakar Rally and guys like you, Victor, and the folks at Sonora and Baja. And so I got to thank all of those folks as well.
Yeah, no, it's been, I mean, obviously it's been awesome watching your journey and I mean, and the accomplishment. I mean, seriously, like nobody will overtake the. Sign me. Literally, that is the way. Sign me up for the hardest possible way to do this race. Please.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that takes, that, and you've done some other, I mean, you've done some other crazy stuff. I mean, you've done, what is it, the Iditarod?
Yeah. I've done a lot of ultra marathon type running events and I was much better at that. Honestly, I've done some hard races, but this was, yeah, to your point, this is hard. It is really hard. Yeah. But awesome. We want more people to do it. We want more Americans to sign up and we've got a great, you know, network to help folks get there. So anybody out there looking to learn more, just hit me up, but you can reach me. And if you see Kyle D. McCoy on Instagram, you can contact me that way or Facebook, Kyle McCoy.
Yeah. I'll drop, I'll have the links in the description so they can get over to your Instagram.
Awesome.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, Kyle, thank you very much, man. I appreciate you taking the time and chatting with us. That's awesome. I can't wait to share the story. This is going to be good.
Of course. Thanks, Victor. And we'll see you soon.
Of course. Thank you. Enjoy.
All right. Bye.
All right. So there you have it. That was Kyle McCoy. And I you know, I can't talk. I literally can't. It is one of those, I don't want to say can't talk. It's such a crazy endeavor to think, you know, like Mo Hart did it last year, you know, finishing all of every single kilometer of the event to make it happen. And in last year, rainstorms and all sorts of stuff going on. Kyle this time around with the mechanical, with the heat, with everything, you know, with a quote unquote seemingly smooth rally, and to be able to do that. And I think that there's a very, very interesting point that he makes too. And that I really like is that he's very like realistic about what he mentioned about his riding. It's like, okay, how much work am I going to have to put in to get faster? And at the end of the day with rally racing, that was your 10th, you know, number 10 finisher in the Dakar Malimoto class, right? That was the top 10 finish for him, riding his pace, doing his thing, having a clean run, navigating correctly, you know, making all of that happen. And okay, what if he wouldn't have had the issue with the switch? You know, that's 1 hour there. You know, just in that. What are some of the other things? And then you don't know. I mean, that hour actually ends up being on the clock. It's an hour and maybe 15 minutes or an hour and 20 minutes because you're clapped out from having to deal with that. And then now you've got to go back, get on the bike and continue on. And so it's very interesting, you know, to see like how all of these things done and how he changed it and saying, you know, minute management, managing those minutes, making sure that it's like trying to get things done as quickly as possible. And I can only imagine, you know, I think it was Willem Avenant that said it, you know, everything's for sale in the bivouac except time. And that is it's crazy. You know, you think about it, the little chit chatting, the bike not being there, the bike, and yeah, well, it only takes 2 hours to do the, you know, or 3 hours to do the general maintenance on the bike, you know. Yeah, but 3 hours, you know, and you're having to do that every couple of days, and it just, all of it adds up. So it's really awesome to see. Again, congratulations to Kyle on making that happen. It is absolutely crazy to do it. And to his point about the climb helmets, I happen to have scored a F3 carbon some time ago. And yeah, I don't know if they are the lightest on it. I think that is the battle of who has the lightest helmet. But these things are light. I handed it to my dad. We were actually hanging it up. If you guys have seen the videos on YouTube on Adventure Taco Studios, it's hanging up on the wall behind me. And that thing is stupid light. We were like looking to hang it. We're like, what would it do? I'm like, oh, I think those double-sided tape, hooks will work for this. He goes, nah, I don't know. And I hand him the helmet. I'm like, look. And he's like, well, wait a minute. You know, and you when you hand somebody something and they're expecting it to be heavy and then they kind of do that like up down motion, like, oh, this doesn't weigh as much as I thought it was going to be. Man, so awesome. Well, anyway, it is a rainy Sunday it is a rainy Friday. You guys are going to be listening to this on a Sunday. So I hope you guys are enjoying. You're having your morning coffee. You're maybe making some plans to go riding. If you're here in Southern California and the rain has stopped, which it has not. And it is, I don't even remember what day it is. February 2nd, I think. Yeah, something like that. It's going to be some hero dirt. So I've got tools coming. I've got the 790. I need to get that thing done back together, put it on the chopping block, and then get to it. Because I got a 501 and a SoCal rally coming up. So looking forward to that one, hanging out with a bunch of guys, you know, doing some road book stuff. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And then I hear a rumor that Gnarly Dave is going to be making an appearance. I hear Mason Klein will be there, you know, maybe. Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's going to be an awesome event. It's always a great time. Last year had the chance to show up, already requested the time off for this year. So excited for that. So anyway, I got some stuff to do. We got another interview coming up a little bit later today. So I hope you guys are doing well. And yeah. And remember, it'll make sense when you get there. Enjoy the ride. All right, that is a wrap for the Chasing Waypoints podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. Looking forward to our next one coming up. Remember, if you are out riding, do not forget to tag us at Chasing Waypoints. Hashtag Chasing Waypoints. And if you haven't already, get on over to the website. Get signed up for the newsletter, The Bivouac. North America's Rally Raid and Adventure Riding newsletter. Hey, let's have some fun. Let's find out what are you guys up to. Let's get you featured. If you're a brand and looking to get supported, get some eyeballs, get some ears on your business, absolutely hit us up. Send us a message at podcast@chasingwaypoints.com. But anyway, that is a wrap. Remember, shiny side up. See you guys.